When you have that threat of a diesel bill hanging over your head every month, that is very motivating to find solutions.
How Kodiak built an innovative electric grid that's 99% renewable. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a plan for selling Sitka's water moves forward.
I hope you're buying the 100 million gallons of water from us, because that means you're giving us $1 million, and hopefully we're both happy out of that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the federal plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Since 2014, Kodiak has gotten more than 99% of its electricity from renewable energy using a combination of wind and hydro. It's part of a growing trend as cities around the nation aim for a 100% clean energy, but most of those communities are connected to the country's major power grids. Grids that depend on fossil fuel plants to keep them reliable. Kodiak doesn't have that option. Rachel Waldholtz from Alaska's Energy Desk explains how they make it work.
To understand Kodiak's grid, it helps to check out the town's shipping crane, a black and orange beast on the Kodiak waterfront. And I am headed up, well, not to the very tippy top, but pretty high. My tour guide is Rick Kenyazowski with the shipping company Matson.
Make sure you're hard hats are on pretty tight. Gets a little windy.
This crane serves the nation's second largest fishing port, loading freezer containers full of salmon and pollock onto ships. Plus, it handles just about anything else that needs to come in or out of Kodiak.
If you're buying it at Safeway, chances are we brought it in the night before.
And like everything else that runs off electricity here, this crane is entirely powered by renewable energy. So when Kenyazowski approached the head of the local utility to propose replacing Matson's old diesel-powered crane with a giant electric crane,
they said no. His eyes got really big, and he's like, I just don't see it, Rick. Everyone's TVs are going to brown out, and they're going to either hate you or they're going to hate us.
It was a big ask.
Jennifer Richcreek works for the local electric co-op.
The idea of having an electric crane, great, this is our vision, we're electrifying the town with renewable energy. But that load draw on a massive crane was huge. And so looking at it, it was a pretty daunting engineering task again.
And spoiler alert, they did figure it out with some seriously sci-fi stuff. We'll get to that later. The Kodiak Electric Association, or KEA, first set a goal of 95% renewable power back in 2007. And it was pretty ambitious. The Kodiak waterfront is lined with fish processors. Down the road is the nation's largest Coast Guard base. To the south is Kodiak's rocket launch facility. Those are a lot of energy users that need rock-solid, reliable, affordable electricity, which is not exactly what renewables were known for. But the co-op also had a major motivation: the cost of diesel. 10 years ago, Kodiak got about 20% of its power from diesel generators. The rest was hydro, so in a dry year, diesel use could spike. And the cost of diesel was very high and totally unpredictable. Businesses had trouble forecasting their electricity bill. Rich Creek says it was like being held hostage to diesel.
When you have that threat of a diesel bill hanging over your head every month, that is very motivating to find solutions.
So the co-op decided to try something Kodiak has a lot of: wind. In 2009, they installed the first 3 wind turbines. But wind is hard to work with.
Wind is a wild child. Wind is, it does as it pleases. You don't know when the wind is going to blow. You don't know how long it's going to blow. So it's unpredictable, it's variable, it's all over the place.
That's the opposite of how a traditional power plant works. With coal or natural gas, it's there when you need it. So KEA had to figure out how to make its wild child play nice. Specifically, they had to figure out how to manage the handoff from wind to hydropower. Wind might change intensity second to second. Meanwhile, the town's hydropower takes minutes to ramp up. The solution? A bank of batteries. Those can supply energy quickly while the hydro ramps up behind them. And the system worked pretty well. Then came the crane. Rick Kenyazhovsky tells me to hang on as the whole crane starts to move.
Hear that ringing? That means we're gantrying.
Gantrying, or moving sideways to line up with a cargo ship. If I look down and clutch the railing, I can watch the operator lift a container off the ship.
Oh, this is so cool.
Every time that crane lifts a shipping container, it's a massive immediate pull on the grid. And when it drops that container, all that power comes rushing back. So here's where it gets a little sci-fi. Kodiak looked around and decided to try a flywheel. The flywheel is a massive piece of steel. I'll let Rich Creek explain.
There is a 6.5-ton spinning mass. It's in a frictionless vacuum chamber hovered by magnets, which is so cool.
The flywheel stores energy as motion. When there's a surge of energy onto the grid, it spins the flywheel, and it keeps spinning until that energy is needed again. Altogether, it's like a dance or an orchestra. Each piece is watching the rest and responding second by second, millisecond by millisecond. The wind drops suddenly and the flywheel kicks in. As the flywheel fades, the batteries step in. And behind it all, the hydro ramps up. And all of this is really unusual. To integrate lots of variable energy, like wind or solar, onto a grid, you need that moment-by-moment communication. And not many places have mastered it. But Rich Creek says this is the future.
The solutions are out there. They're outside the box, they may be different, but the industry is changing.
So what can Kodiak teach the rest of the world? We'll talk about that next time. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Kodiak.
The University of Alaska Board of Regents meets in Juneau today and tomorrow. Today's agenda includes an update from UA President Jim Johnson on the university's Strategic Pathways, a downsizing initiative. It calls for dissolving the schools of education in Fairbanks and Anchorage and consolidating the program in Juneau. But UA spokesperson Roberta Graham says concerns raised by the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities has resulted in a new plan, which keeps students, faculty, and staff in Anchorage and Fairbanks.
There will still be one College of Education. It will still be headquartered at the University of Alaska Southeast with one executive dean.
Graham adds the move will still trim jobs and streamline operations.
The colleges themselves would be dissolved, and the deans essentially at those two campuses would go away.
Regents will also hear about the university's compliance with a voluntary resolution agreement with the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. Graham says there is a new scorecard showing steps made by each UA campus to meet Title IX requirements.
That scorecard now reflects new information that both support the complainants and the respondents in Title IX cases.
Regents will also consider President Johnson's performance and compensation package. Earlier this week, President Johnson wrote Alaska's congressional delegation urging it to quickly resolve the Trump administration's directive to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. The Obama-era immigration policy protected certain undocumented immigrants brought to the United States as children. Alaska has 138 DACA recipients, according to the Center for American Progress. Johnson said in his letter that failing to resolve the issue through congressional action could prevent students from fulfilling their academic and professional goals and would ultimately hurt the state's economy. The Alaska Fire Marshal's Office has determined the fire that claimed the lives of five girls in the Matsu Valley Butte area last week was accidental and cooking related. The state medical examiner's office positively identified the deceased as 3-year-old Jaylin Flores, 6-year-old Sophia Flores, 7-year-old Liliana Flores, 8-year-old Nevaeh Flores, and 12-year-old Alexis Quakenbush. Fire Marshal Dave Tyler told reporters today that all five girls died of smoke inhalation after their mobile home caught fire early last Thursday morning. Tyler did not give specifics on what appliances may have been in use when the fire started, but said burn marks and other indicators pointed definitively to the kitchen. He says the fire was not caused by faulty outlets or wiring. According to Tyler, fires in mobile homes are prone to spreading quickly due to airflow and materials used. Tyler says there is no evidence of functioning smoke detectors in the mobile home at the time of the fire. It's unclear when the cooking that started the fire began, and Tyler says criminal charges are absolutely not being considered at this time. Additional details are on hold until the fire investigator makes a complete report. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a disabled fish processor is in legal limbo in Dutch Harbor.
With the exception of the possibility that the responsible party is willing to step up, there's kind of this big gaping hole of no jurisdiction.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Education scholarships and grants for ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, are available. To learn where the possibilities this education can take you, visit beanengineeralaska.com. This community message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil. Energy lives here.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development announced today it's sending $7 million to 14 Alaska tribal organizations, much of it for housing. Many of the grants will fund village construction from Chignik Lagoon to Chistochina. But HUD also selected one Anchorage grantee. Cook Inlet Tribal Council and Cook Inlet Housing Authority are due to receive $600,000 to rehabilitate a commercial building in Midtown. Says a Jero Hansen is a spokeswoman for the Housing Authority. She says the plan is to add 20 apartments to the second floor of 3400 Spinard Road. But she says the HUD grant is just the first piece of a complicated funding package.
The building is old and needs new mechanical systems. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. And we're not sure whether that's going to pencil out to be the smartest use of the money.
Jero Hansen says the demand for affordable housing in the area is high, and she says the project would help revitalize a section of the road her organization calls Middle Spinard between Benson and Minnesota Boulevards.
There are a lot of mom-and-pop businesses along the roadway. We feel if you start to add that housing component, it adds to the neighborhood, it adds to the vibrancy.
All 14 Alaska grants were awarded competitively. The $7 million total is a slight dip from prior years and comes on top of the $95 million in Indian Housing Block grants that's distributed annually to Alaska. Raw water may be shipped out of Sitka within the next 3 years. At least that's the promise of two bulk water contracts approved by the Sitka Assembly on Tuesday night. One came from startup in the business of bottling, while the other is a repeat customer who has spent decades trying to sell raw water to countries around the world. KCAW's Emily Kwong reports.
Rain and melted snow.
You've probably seen bottled water commercials for Fiji or Evian.
So that you don't have to go to the Alps to drink it.
But what about Eckert Fine Beverages? That's the company that wants to package Sitka's raw water as a luxury good. Their plan is to pump water at the Gary Paxton Industrial Park in 40-foot containers bound for California for treatment and bottling. Eckert is the first company to propose shipping water in small volumes, an idea which proved tantalizing for several members of the Sitka Assembly. Here's Mayor Matthew Hunter.
I hope you're buying the 100 million gallons of water from us, because that means you're giving us $1 million, and hopefully we're both happy out of that. So may we have a long, happy relationship here.
The water will be shipped at 1 cent a gallon. Over the phone, owner Michael Eckert said his family-run business has been around since 1984. This would be their first attempt at selling beverages.
We're more marketers than we are beverage people, and that's why it's something that's, you know, going to be a luxury brand. We've done that before in other industries, and we're going to start small and do the best to build it as big as we can.
Eckert Fine Beverages has a lot to prove in a short amount of time. The company must ship 75,000 gallons in the next 3 years in order to keep their contract. The second contract came from Fred Paley at Arctic Blue Water, Alaska, Incorporated. Paley has been trying to break into the bulk water business for decades without shipping a single drop so far. He first approached Sitka in 1996.
I think we were a bit early. We were focused strictly on China at that point.
That was before there was any water pipeline to speak of. With infrastructure at the dock now and a new business partner in Alaska Fresh, which has committed $20 million to the project, Paley thinks this time will be different. He told the assembly he has interest from a potential buyer in Mexico.
So they're talking about building a tank farm in Manzanilla and taking the water from there. So I think this time the timing is could be right for the bulk water export. And I know we've all been a bit frustrated with it and have put a lot of money and time and effort into it. And after 30 years, I still haven't given up.
Under this new contract, Arctic Blue wants to ship 50 million gallons of raw water over the next 20 years at 1 cent a gallon. Assemblymember Steven Eisenbeiss had major reservations.
I've seen a lot of speculation come and go with our water. People tying it up, trying to get exclusive rights, only to fizzle out and disappear.
Eisenbeiss is referring to Alaska Bulk Water Incorporated. CEO Terry Trapp had exclusive rights to Sitka's water for nearly 10 years before a series of missed payment deadlines ended his contract. Assemblymember Bob Petruski reasoned it was worth another try with another company.
Well, if we pass the contract, there's a chance that there's going to be water produced. If we don't pass the contract, there's no chance that any water will be produced. So simple one for me. I'm going to vote for it.
Both purchase agreements were ultimately approved by the assembly. And in case you're wondering, the contract states that local needs for water, both drinking and hydroelectric use, are first priority, and that the administrator can limit commercial sale if need be. And if other customers come knocking, the city still has over 75% of its water available for sale. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
An international big mountain ski and snowboard competition, which brought an economic boost to Haines for 3 winters, is not returning to Alaska in 2018. Free Ride World Tour organizers say the expense of putting on a competition in the remote Haines backcountry is the main reason they are not coming back this winter. KHNS's Emily Files has more.
If he sticks that, what a combination to start off from. Holy wow. Moly.
Commentators marveled as skiers and snowboarders carved descents through the deep snow of the Haines Mountains in March of 2017. The Freeride World Tour includes a series of stops where athletes build up points based on the skill and creativity of their runs.
Oh, that is a Greek tragedy of a line.
Most of the Freeride's competition venues are near ski resorts in places like Verbier, Switzerland and Fieberbrunn, Austria. That made the Haines stop unusual. There is no ski resort here. People either hike, snow machine, or take helicopters into the backcountry.
The things that make Haines so challenging also are the things that make it so special and so wonderful.
Tom Winter is a spokesman for the ski and snowboard competition. He says the wildness and remoteness of Haines makes it appealing. Some athletes call it a ski mecca. But those same factors make it very expensive. In Haines, the Freeride used helicopters to fly all the athletes, event personnel, and equipment to the mountaintop venue. That was the biggest expense.
I think you're looking at $1 million plus for the Haines stop, if not even $1.5 million when all the costs are added, so it's quite expensive. And that's mostly based on the logistics side and the fact that you can't just pile your gear in a snowcat and bump it up the mountain.
People in Haines already knew the chances of the Freeride returning in 2018 were slim. The event lost its title sponsor, Swatch. Without that financing, organizers said coming back to Alaska would be difficult. The decision was made official September 12th when the Freeride announced its schedule for the 2018 competition. The Haines and Chamonix, France stops were replaced by brand new venues in Hakuba, Japan, and Golden, British Columbia.
We'll miss them. You know,
I look forward to heli season every year.
Deborah Davis is the store manager at Haines Mountain Market Cafe. The market was a popular gathering spot for the freeride athletes. Davis says the skiers and snowboarders ordered lots of coffee and smoothies.
You know, so they're familiar faces. We look forward to seeing them. And they spend a lot of time here on their down days.
Haines' new tourism director, Carol Ann Wooten, was welcoming visitors at the cruise ship dock on the day the freeride announced its 2018 schedule. In the summer, Haines sees a steady stream of tourists from cruise ships. But in the winter, business is much slower. Big events like the freeride make a difference.
Freeride brought in people who were staying in our hotels, who were eating at our establishments and shopping in our stores. And so I would definitely say that this is something that we would like them to come back.
Tom Winter with the Freeride says coming back to Haines is a possibility. After all, it was dubbed the dream stop by organizers.
It's not going to happen this year, but that's okay. You know, change happens, and if things line up, I definitely think that we'll be back there, and I hope so, because Haines is special, and people will always remember Haines, really. As a special place.
Even though the competition dropped Haines from its calendar and the financial chances of it returning are uncertain, Tourism Director Wooten says it likely raised Haines' profile as a winter recreation destination. That means Haines could still get an economic boost from the freeride, even if it's not an official stop on the tour. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The fishing vessel Accutan no longer has a crew, and the ship's 130,000 pounds of salmon has been offloaded. The processor has been anchored in Unalaska's Captain's Bay since late August, and there's no indication the boat will be leaving soon. Here's Ports Director Peggy McLaughlin.
The reality of it is there's just a huge legal ball that needs to be worked through before any real decision can be made.
After a disastrous fishing season as a processor in Bristol Bay, the vessel's owner went broke, the crew went unpaid, and now the ship is disabled and unable to move. McLaughlin says the interagency task force that united to prevent the boat from spilling fuel, oil, and other chemicals into the bay are in limbo unless the situation turns dire.
Right now, with the exception of the possibility that the responsible party is willing to step up, there's kind of this big gaping hole of no jurisdiction until something more dramatic happens with the vessel.
McLaughlin thinks the boat is stable for now and not in danger of sinking. That said, there is still fuel on board and the ship is in a precarious location for the environment.
It's in front of salmon streams. It's in front of native allotment lands. It's also in close proximity to Westward Seafood's intake. So it's not in a good place to have a problem.
In late August, responders removed almost 16,000 gallons of oil and sludge from the Accutan. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation estimates up to 23,000 gallons of marine diesel and other chemicals remain on board. McLaughlin says the city's ultimate goal is to keep the vessel intact and get it out of Unalaska waters. A team of responders is monitoring the vessel. GCI is looking into what it would take to bring faster internet to Unalaska. The telecommunications company is evaluating if fiber would be a financially feasible solution. Right now, they are in the exploratory process. Spokesperson Heather Handyside said the company is surveying a route between a fiber facility in Leevelock and Unalaska.
If we are to do a build-out of a fiber cable, it'll help us understand how to best engineer that cable so it can withstand all of the elements or the obstacles that it might encounter.
Obstacles such as strong currents, shipwrecks, and deep and varied terrain. For them, it's compelling that Unalaska is the top fishing port in the nation.
I think there's promise with the change in climate that it could get even busier. And so we're taking all of those things into account as we consider whether to make this investment.
If built, she estimates the cable would cost tens of millions of dollars, and GCI is planning to foot the entire bill. Currently, Unalaska is only served by satellite, making the internet slow and expensive. The marine survey is expected to be completed by mid-October, and Handyside says GCI expects to have made a decision about the project by early next year. Kodiak College, which is part of the University of Alaska Anchorage, will soon make a bachelor's degree the go-to for aspiring nurses. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
In previous years, students have been able to get an associate's degree at the college and then add classes to build up to a bachelor's. In fall 2018, the college will revise its program to reflect the changing job market and offer only bachelor's degrees. Margie Meady is the associate professor of nursing at Kodiak College. She says not only do hospitals now want job applicants with at least a bachelor's, but they also want the most educated nurses they can get.
So the whole scale, the whole shift in education has moved up along with the baccalaureate program. The master's program went to the doctorate and so on.
Meady says that's a barrier some associate degree students run into once they earn their degrees.
And when they leave and go to the lower 48, they call me and tell me that they have trouble finding a job down there because there's baccalaureate nurse preference for hiring down there.
Meady says Providence Health and Services hires most of Kodiak College's local graduates, and the program change is in large part a response to the hospital's new policy. Providence communications specialist Carly Franz says starting on January 1st, 2017, a bachelor's degree in nursing became a prerequisite for new hires. She says hospitals across the country have been trying to implement this kind of policy change for many years.
What you get additionally with a bachelor's in nursing is you learn more leadership skills, and it sort of preps you more to be a nurse leader. So that's an added advantage, and it makes those nurses a lot more marketable.
She says Providence will not ask nurses hired before January 1st to go back for further education. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Adeline Baxter in Juneau, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Emily Files in Haines, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by BP, investing in the next generation of Alaskans by sponsoring programs like the University of Alaska's Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. Learn more about how BP gives back to local communities at bp.com/Alaska. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.